My name is Kristen Dobbin, and I'm the iPinch Communications Specialist.
And I'm Brian Egan, I'm the Project Manager for iPinch.
And we're here today with four of our team members from the iPinch community-based initiative, A Case of Access, an Uvialuit Engagement with the Smithsonian's McFarland Collection. So we'll just start off by going around and introducing ourselves. So if Natasha, if you don't mind starting.
Hi, I'm Natasha Lyons, and I was the project lead and project manager for this project.
Hi, my name is Chuck Arnold. I first became involved with the project when I was director of the Prince of Wales Northern Heritage Center in Yellowknife. I retired shortly thereafter and have continued in the role, I guess, as an independent researcher, primarily to prepare descriptions of items in the McFarland Collection.
My name is Kathy Cockney. I'm the manager of the Indian Valley Cultural Resource Center. I help organize the trip and I guess the cultural advisor for the group.
And my name is Kate Hennessy. I'm an assistant professor at the School of Interactive Arts and Technology here at Simon Fraser University. And I joined the project in 2009 just as the delegation was headed to the Smithsonian, and worked since then with documentation of that visit and the production of the Inuvialuit Living History website that everyone here on the call and other members of our team worked on together.
Great. So we were hoping to just start off the call by having someone introduce the project for us.
Well, this is Natasha. The project kind of got started. Kathy and Mervyn and I had been working together for a number of years on a project up north, and in 2008 we started to talk about the McFarland Collection and how great it would be to learn more about it. It's a collection of several hundred ethnographic items that were collected by a Hudson's Bay trader in the 1850s in the Anderson River area of the Inuvialuit settlement region, and it's a very rich collection, a lot of clothing and skins and, skin items, organic items, and it's a real treasure, but it's very cost prohibitive to have the collection itself travel, and so Kathy and I talked about applying for some funding to take elders and other Inuvialuit members to Washington, and that's what we did, and our seed funding came through iPinch, so that was great timing for us. We went in 2009 to visit the collection with a pretty big group, I think 12 people all told, some Inuvialuit and anthropology folks and media folks, and we had a week-long visit with the collection and documented a lot of knowledge about it and discovered a lot of things that we didn't know that we wanted to pursue research on.
So, Natasha, can you kind of speak a bit more about the methodology? How did you guys approach this project? What kind of methods did you use?
Oh, sure. Well, basically, I mean, we were very interested in using a participatory, community-based kind of method. The method was really emergent in a lot of ways. When we figured out what we needed to do, which was get to Washington, then that's where Kathy and I put a lot of energy, and Kathy did a lot of work trying to figure out the right people in the community who should come and that sort of thing. And things evolved. When we were in Washington itself, we were documenting a lot of knowledge. We were also generating a lot of questions. That in and of itself led other people in the Inuvialuit community and other researchers as well to pursue questions when folks got back to back up north. And so really it was, I mean, it's been kind of on the ground moving. We've tried to be very, have a very open communication with each other and just keep the project moving forward and keep the sort of massive amount of information that we were gathering channeled into something which ultimately was the website.
Kathy, you were going to talk about what inspired the project at the start and how it got started, and I'd also be interested in learning a bit more. Natasha talked about selecting the individuals to go. How did that come about and how did you approach that?
Certainly what inspired the project is the collection itself. It was gathered in the 1800s, and many of the clothing and the tools that are at the Smithsonian are probably no longer made well, they're really traditional Inuvialuit material culture. So we thought it was important for not only for researchers but for the Inuvialuit community to go down and also have a look at what's available or what's at the Smithsonian. So what we did was I went on the radio, and everybody listens to the radio in the north because they like to send messages, and they pretty well get all their information from the radio. So I went on the radio and talked about the project and how we would like to select elders to participate, and the response was really good. There was quite a few, maybe about 8 elders from the region contacted me. As for the youth, there was a couple of youth that did contact me with expressing their interest, but we had to be selective in the youth because probably one of the challenges we had was trying to get passports for all the people that were going to go to Washington.
So just to follow up on one aspect there, so one of the objective or part of the project was to bring youth and elders together around the collection?
Yes, it's always good to have elders involved because you know they have the knowledge, and even though they may not make the tools anymore, they may have seen their parents or grandparents making the tools, which a couple of the elders did say that they witnessed their grandparents using like a bow and arrow. And for the youth, like the youth up here are very interested in learning about our traditional Inuvialuit culture because we've gone through so much change, and any chance that youth, especially like maybe the teenage youth, that if they have an opportunity to learn something, then they really grasp, which they did when we were giving presentations in the schools.
Mm. Right. So what was the age range of the participants?
Well, we couldn't really go younger than 19 because if you take underage, like youth, there's more challenges, I guess, you have to face because them being minors. So we focused 19 and over.
And then how old was Helen?
My auntie Helen, she was, 76?
Mm-hmm. Great, thank you, Kathy.
So we were also wondering whether there were any challenges in organizing the project.
This is Kate here. I think everybody can probably speak to the challenges of organizing the project because it's a very multi-dimensional project. So for I won't speak for Natasha and Kathy, but I can just hint at the fact that, you know, they've talked about the complications and some of the challenges of bringing people together for the actual trip to the Smithsonian. And I know that was many, many years in the making to get people to Washington. It's quite expensive to travel from the north, so cost and funding and continued funding is an issue for all parts of the project. And then I think it was also a good challenge for all of us to try to bring together the documentation, the research materials, to translate those into the Inuvialuit Living History website and to work as a group to collaboratively produce the content for that exhibition. I think Chuck can probably speak also to some of the challenges around co-curation of objects and working on the sort of knowledge production side of this project, which was a big part of it. But in general, I would just say funding and paying close attention to what makes a participatory project. So Natasha led the team in drafting a project charter at the beginning of our work together, where we all talked about our goals and priorities for the research, which included the applied part of the project, the production of the website, but what people wanted to get from this work, how we would work together, how would we respect one another, and the various contributions that we could make at various times in a long-term project, mm-hmm. And coming back to revisit those objectives and goals, how we wanted to publish, what kinds of projects we would take on, how we would use one another's time, given that some of us are only Stephen Loring and I are salaried academics, mm-hmm. And our Kathy and our New Gallup partners, Mervyn and Albert and James and other participants don't have that kind of support. So it's balancing different levels of support for the project, which are all challenges in when thinking about project sustainability that we all still struggle with.
Yeah.
I guess another challenge that we could probably all speak to is what you just said, Kate, about making a project like this sustainable. So we tried different methods of sharing what we had learned with the Inuvialuit community. It's a very large community of about 5,000 people. Many live in the north. Many also live in other parts of the world. And so one of the things that we did prior to the website being launched was to produce kind of a plain language, glossy newsletter that, or more of a report about the project about a year before the website was launched, to talk about what we had been doing and to share some of that and to invite other Inuvialuit to comment on what we were doing. We also did a series of outreach visits in the north that Mervyn and Kathy and Albert and others were a part of, and Albert and Mervyn and I did some interviewing. Kate did some interviewing as well. So there were kind of, like Kate said, there were a lot of moving parts. And then once we had some of the, you know, that information, it was a matter of how do we kind of winnow it down for the website. So really, the start off part. The visit to Washington that this project, A Case of Access, funded was really just kind of opening a really big and great can of worms. And we're still moving forward here, probably for a long time, because we haven't even gotten into the natural history side of the collection.
And I just wanted to say, Kathy mentioned going into the schools. That was a really important part of this project, both before the project started, before the website project started, so around the time of the trip to the Smithsonian, and then after the website was in production. Kathy, did you want to say anything about the school visits that you did, and that we did, and that most of us participated in at some point?
I was quite surprised at the reaction of the Inuvialuit people when we advertised for the public presentations and the reaction of the students in the schools. We only gave presentations in Inuvik and Tuktoyaktuk, but the reaction of the students in the schools was really wonderful, because they were really interested in what we were presenting, and they did have quite a few questions, especially the students in Tuktoyaktuk school, because they know the area. They know that, you know, some of them do travel in the Anderson River area. And even if they didn't, you know, travel in the area, they their parents or their grandparents, you know, maybe came from there. So they were able to identify with the project and the area that we were working in. And even the public presentations, like, they were well attended, and people were... even in Tuck, they said that they really do. The ad that we put up really made them curious on what we did find out when we went to the Smithsonian, looking at our traditional culture material. And even in Inuvik, when one of the comments was like, when I didn't start speaking about the artifacts, they. One of the elders told me that I should be the one talking about the artifacts at the Smithsonian, because that's our material, our grandparents. and mm-hmm. our ancestors made those tools, so we should take ownership mm-hmm. of the presentations in the community. So mm-hmm. the interest was there and was amazing.
So Kathy, could I just follow up on that and switch the focus a little bit and ask you to share your kind of impressions or memories of when you were actually in Washington and the group was looking at the artifacts. Can you tell us kind of what kind of stories and reactions were elicited by the Inuvialuit folks who were engaged with the objects in the collection? And were any objects in the collection particularly memorable for anyone on the team?
I think for individually, they probably different objects like appeal to you, but as for the collection, I think everybody really enjoyed looking at all the artifacts and just watching their reaction when Stephen would bring out another group of artifacts, and it was interesting to see the men's reaction with the bow and arrows, and because we don't use bows and arrows anymore, and they're not made the traditional way anyway up here, and it was nice to see. We had a seamstress along from Tuktoyaktuk, and she, as soon as she seen that, like the mitts and the gloves and the shoes, she wanted to make patterns right away, and she really got to work making the patterns because she wanted to learn how to make, especially the gloves, because we don't really make gloves here anymore, traditionally anyway.
Mm. Do you remember James, how excited he was about the atlatls?
And
the
yeah.
James and Mervyn and were chasing Stephen around the center, trying to find more and more, and they were so excited about that. And I think James went home actually and was working on that atlatl. I know he also made snow goggles for his daughter Myrna.
Can you describe what the first objects are like? Sorry, what
an
was
an atlatl is? Let's turn that over to Chuck.
Sure.
Okay, well, thank you. Yes, an atlatl, more commonly known as a throwing board, is used with spears and harpoons when hunting from a kayak. And basically, it gives you more accuracy and power when you're throwing a weapon from a seated position. Mm-hmm. And there were several in the collection, and I don't think any of the Inuvialuit participants had actually seen one before, but they had heard of them, they knew of them, and as soon as James Polkiak, for instance, picked it up, he knew exactly how to hold it and how it would be used. So it was almost like this knowledge was coming from the past through the artifact and into the hands of a modern-day hunter. So it was pretty phenomenal to be able to see that happen.
Yeah, that's amazing. Does anyone else want to add any other memories from the collection?
I want to ask Chuck what was most memorable for him in the collection.
Well, before I do that, I'd just like to add one other reaction or a reaction from another source. In preparing the descriptions and interpreting some of the artifacts, I worked very closely with Daryl Nassigalowak in Tuktoyaktuk. Daryl is a younger person, I'd say in his late 30s, perhaps.
Yes,
he has intense interest in traditional Inuvialuit technology. He's read almost every book there is to read. He's talked with his relatives and other elders in Tuktoyaktuk, and he's tried on his own to make many of the traditional tools. So when we're writing up the descriptions, I would send photographs to Daryl. We get on the phone for about a week. We spend an hour or two every night just going over them. Daryl would help me understand how they're used, how they're made, and then I would try to take his words and put them into curatorial descriptions. But almost every artifact, the men's artifacts at any rate, Daryl would have a story that he had heard from one of his elders. For instance, Kathy mentioned the bows, the incredible bows that are part of the collection. Daryl would talk about his grandfather, Edgar Kotikok, and remember a story that his grandfather told him when he was out hunting a polar bear, and all he had was his bow and arrow. This goes back quite a ways. But the polar bear got close to him one time, and he pulled out his bow and arrow and shot the bear, and the so powerful, the arrow passed right through the bear, killing it, but passing right through the carcass. So those are the kinds of things that, you know, the collection has really brought those memories to the forefront, and I think it has made this truly a living history project.
This is Kathy. I was going to mention that, you know, the artifacts were there for how long? Almost 100 years without really Inuvialuit, you know, looking at them. And then I think it was quite different to see that people's reaction and, you know, for the Inuvialuit to once again to be holding those objects was something else, I think. Mm-hmm. That's one of the things that what brings is memorable for me.
So, Kathy, I wonder, or anyone else, I wonder if you could share your thoughts on how the youth that were along on the trip reacted or felt about viewing these objects. I can understand the elders who might have some kind of understanding of some of the objects from their history or from their parents, but the youth, it must have seemed somewhat farther away from them. So how did the youth react to seeing these objects?
I think they were excited, but I think they stood back and watched for the first part and tried to figure out how to get involved. You know, there was a lot of talking and a lot of excitement going on, and both of them over the course of the week, I think, kind of found a niche for themselves. They both did little projects while they were there. Shani did some interviewing, and Karis was doing some photography, and she was doing some drawing. And anybody else?
I wanted to say that the youth took quite a role in collaborating with the filmmakers from the Inuvialuit Communication Society who came on the trip, who made a documentary called A Case of Access, the Inuvialuit Smithsonian Project, that was broadcast on APTN and then became a part of the Inuvialuit Living History website. But Shani played a really important role as an interviewer in the project, talking to elders and being that person who could really ask those questions of James and Albert and Kathy and Frida and Helen. So that was, I thought, very important to have them there.
Mm-hmm. So just to follow up on that, Could you tell us a little bit about the follow-up that happened after the group returned from the Smithsonian? So you mentioned the school visits and also this documentary project. I don't know if there's anything else.
There was the immediate sort of media work, so a lot of photography, a lot of documentation. There was the filming of the documentary, so over the next 8 months or so, that film was produced, and we went into production with the Inuvialuit Living History website. But in the course of that, as we've already talked about, there was field work, there was going back out into the communities, there was training with Albert and Mervyn, with Natasha and myself, to go out into the field and to do interviews in the Inuvialuit settlement region related to how we should translate this information into a publicly available website, mm-hmm. what that should look like, what people hope to see. So that consultation and actually going on the ground out to talk to people was really crucial. Mm-hmm. And then
the other part of that, I think, was that people came back and, like I said earlier, started to pursue their own projects. Frida immediately started sewing and showing patterns around her seamstress friends, and other folks were, like Daryl Nezogalowek, as he was learning more about the collection, was trying to recreate things, trying to figure out how things were made. And I think all of us at one point or another, whether we were in the North or not, experienced kind of all the chitter-chatter that was going on in the community itself. People were talking a lot about what we had done. We wrote some articles that were sort of in magazine-type formats, one that went into the In-Flight magazine for the Canadian North. So, and Kathy could speak more to that, but I know Chuck encountered that talking to folks in the North, being in the North. People were just talking about it, and that was really exciting for us.
So maybe we could, someone could speak to, you know, what they think the long-term effects of this project will be, you know, both for the individuals who went to the Smithsonian and also for the larger communities.
Well, I think they're yet to be determined. I mean, anecdotally, I think that we know that this project is going to survive in people's memories for quite a while. Mm-hmm. But the tool that we've been working on to develop, the website, I think is going to go a long way to make sure that this collection stays in the public mind. It'll be used, I'm sure, in schools. Hopefully, people outside of schools will refer to it on an ongoing basis. I've heard from several people that, you know, it really has inspired them to learn more about their history and culture and get into some of the other things that have been written and, you know, just talk more generally amongst themselves about history and culture and why it's so important that we grasp hold of these things. Mm-hmm.
And another thing that maybe Kathy can speak to is the Inuvialuit sewing project that's in development that we're working on. This is a project that would take some of the patterns that were traced in the Smithsonian, transform them into usable paper patterns, and make them available to Inuvialuit seamstresses. Kathy, do you want to say anything about that project?
Well, my original plan was just to take all of the patterns that Frida Rowdy had made while we were there and mass produce them. You know, put them on maybe a large sheet of paper so that we could give them out to seamstresses in the region. And hopefully that will come about. You know, it's just something that, you know, we could give back to the community, because a lot of the clothing that we see in at the Smithsonian is they're no longer made, and it would be nice to give out the patterns to seamstresses in the region so that they could start making these products again.
And I think while we originally thought that the patterns might be disseminated through the website, we realized by discussing it and Kathy talking to people in the community that it's more appropriate to keep them off the website and to distribute them physically as patterns. That was an interesting outcome, I think, mm-hmm. of a project that became a digital project, that not everything is suitable to put online. Mm-hmm. So that's, I think, one of the outcomes mm-hmm. Related to the project.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the concerns that the people, especially in the communities, had was copyright and the danger of maybe a large company taking patterns and mass producing. But then there was also concern too that we have to share the information among the Inuvialuit, so they said that go ahead and make the patterns, but you know, keep it within the community.
So
another outcome that I'd like to mention too is that in conjunction with the work on the website, we were able to engage Myrna Pokiak, a young Inuvialuit educator, curriculum developer, to prepare lesson plans, five individual lesson plans each year at two levels within the school system that will help educators in the K-12 system use the information in the website and bring it into the classroom. And I think that this is really one of the more important legacies of the project.
Mm-hmm. Were there any outcomes that were really surprising for the team?
Well, I think just the lack of engagement that we're talking about in the community was hoped for, but also a really great surprise.
Not only within the Inuvialuit community, I think through Natasha's efforts, our project was selected as the inaugural initiative under Aurora Research Institute's public program, where they had brought researchers who involved in different northern projects to go to several communities in the Northwest Territories and give presentations. So Merv and Joe and I spent about a month primarily at Fort Smith, Yellowknife, and in Inuvik giving presentations on the project. And as we expected, the Inuvialuit who heard the presentations were keenly interested, but others were as well. I think people universally were interested in the project and fascinated with the materials that are in the collection and really intrigued with plans for carrying the project further.
And somebody called Mervin their hero for the work that he'd done. That was exciting.
Yeah, that's really nice. So there's been lots of mention about the Inuvialuit Living History website. So I was just hoping that someone could give a little bit more detail about what the website is.
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. One of the things I was just thinking about listening to Chuck and Kathy and Natasha is, I wouldn't say a surprising outcome, but a very welcome outcome, was the willingness of the Smithsonian Institution to allow our team to completely rewrite the curatorial descriptions of objects in the collection. That's not something that would have been acceptable in the past, but there was an openness to the community and the team members here taking those digital records that are created by the institution, bringing them into a new digital context, which is the Inuvialuit Living History website, rewriting the descriptions, reworking the images, adding information, opening it up to the community to contribute knowledge to, and having that representation sit side by side with the original institutional collection. So that, I think, was a remarkable feature of this project, and I hope that it inspires and facilitates more projects where originating communities can use all of the digital tools and this new digital environment of digital heritage and digital museum collections, and use that to their advantage to really take that and transform it into something new and different. That was really the spirit of the Inuvialuit Living History website project. Once we were in Washington, it was very clear that that it was kind of a pity that only a few people from the Inuvialuit community could actually be there in the collection, holding the objects, talking about them, talking to them, feeling caribou hide, from so long ago, looking at beautiful beads inside parkas and all of the amazing hunting tools, and somehow this experience had to be extended beyond just the people who could be there in the museum support center. So we wanted to find a way to use and take advantage of the digital initiative of the Smithsonian, especially since it was a partner of the Reciprocal Research Network here, based here at the Museum of Anthropology at UBC. As a partner, they were already sharing their digital data with the Reciprocal Research Network, and the Reciprocal Research Network has a very user-friendly API, this application programming interface. It's a little software toolkit that allows developers to republish digital information. So we worked with the developers of the RRN to take information through the RRN API to bring all the McFarlane collection data out and republish that as a digital exhibit in the Inuvialuit Living History site. So that's kind of the body of the collection in the site. But then in addition to that, it gives a history of the McFarlane collection. It gives a very kind of nice documentary of the trip to the Smithsonian, people interacting with the objects. It shows the documentary film, A Case of Access, and has presented it so that the film is interactive with object records. So when you watch a segment of the film, if someone's handling a pair of gloves, for example, a record of gloves will show up next to the video, and that changes as you watch the film, and it allows you to stop the video and go and investigate and look more at that object. And then it also gave us an opportunity to tag objects in relation to each other in ways that they hadn't been associated before in the Smithsonian catalog. So part of Chuck's process with Daryl Nasagalawak, and part of the rewriting of the curatorial descriptions, was dividing the objects into new classifications. So thinking about manufacturing techniques and what they were made from, what their uses were. The uses and the way you think about using objects is different from the way McFarlane would have recorded their use. Mm-hmm. So now you could search by looking at sea mammal hunting or dance or something broader, and you have the ability to tag and organize objects so that they can be thought of a different way. Also adding Sigleton dialect terms to all of the objects, so you can search using the Sigleton dialect. And in addition to that, cross-referencing the object records with images that were recorded in the course of the visit to the Smithsonian. So when you see an object, it's not just a static object. You see it being held by contemporary Inuvialuit people, and that changes the representation of the collection, I think. And for me, that was the intention of this project, and that's what I think we all worked quite hard to manifest. Now I think our challenge is to find ways to improve the accessibility of the site for people, improve ways of contributing information, and finding ways to fund potentially workshops or other kinds of projects that would bring people together to engage with the site. Because like all projects that depend on social media for content, we can't rely on people's free labor to provide content. I think there needs to be more context and maybe more facilitation and support for building on the knowledge that's already there.
Does anyone else have anything they want to add?
I'd like to say thanks to all my collaborators.
Absolutely.
Have a good time.
Absolutely.
So I wanted to thank everyone for a great introduction to the project, and I certainly learned a lot about the project today, and makes me very keen to go back to the website and watch those videos again. The videos are wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
I have lots more questions, but I think we'll probably cut it off at that point, and
mm-hmm.
I'll direct my questions in a personal manner.
So for our listeners, if you'd like more information about A Case of Access, please visit the iPinch website at www.sfu.ca/iPinch or the Inuvialuit Living History website at www.inuvialuitlivinghistory.ca.